Let's go ahead and open our Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 12, verse number 12, where I want to kind of roll back and reset the situation that we were in the middle of last session. We're at Gilgal. This is the Gilgal gathering that happened after King Saul defeated Nahash the Ammonite up at Jabesh-Gilead as his first military act, as his first big conquest of a foreign people as king. And Samuel has brought them back to Gilgal, down near the ruins of Jericho, to restate the kingship arrangement for King Saul. And among other things, he takes them back and reminds them of their history up to this point. You know, almost 400 years of history in the land. And he brings it to its climax here in verse number 12. When you saw that Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, "No, but a king shall reign over us." When he who is your God was your king. And so Samuel was quite upset that they wanted a king. God told him, don't be as upset about them rejecting you as them rejecting me. That's the big problem. And so God had Samuel warn them what it would be like to have a human king like they wanted. And even with all that warning, they said, no, we want a king. We have to have a king. We have to deal with a king in this crisis. And so God said to Samuel, go ahead and let them have the king they're looking for, but tell them when it goes bad, when it all turns sour, not to come crying to me, because I warned them what it was going to be like. So verse 13, Samuel continues, now behold, the king whom you've chosen. So there he is. King Saul stands a good foot taller than the average Israeli. For whom you asked, behold, he who is has set a king over you. So you got what you wanted. Now we have a repeat of conditionality, something we've seen from God before, all the way back to the book of Deuteronomy when Moses presented God's warning that if you keep the covenant, you get blessings. If you reject the covenant, you get curses. Verse 14, if you will fear he who is and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of he who is, and if both you and the king who reigns over you will follow he is your God, it will be well. So if you and your new king and every king that follows him will do the right thing, follow the covenant, everything will be fine. You'll have the blessings. But, verse 15, if you will not obey the voice of he who is, but rebel against the commandment of he who is, then the hand of he who is will be against you and your king. So it won't matter if you've got this really tough-looking guy that looks good in a uniform and who can go out and fight for you. If you do it wrong, I will take you down. I mean, that's, again, the warning in the book of Deuteronomy. Verse 16, and this is where we kind of wrapped up last time. Now, therefore, stand still and see this great thing that he who is will do before your eyes. Is it not wheat harvest today? So that tells us it's probably the third month of the Jewish year. So we're talking about that transition point between late spring into the beginning of summer. Doesn't rain during this time in Israel. The rains kind of turn off shortly before Passover. in the first month of the Jewish year, there in late March, early April. They don't turn on again until after the Feast of Tabernacles has wrapped up, later, say, late October, beginning of November. So it's dry during wheat harvest. That's the point. I will call upon He who is, that He may send you thunder and rain. And you shall know and see that your wickedness is great, which you've done in the sight of He who is, in asking for yourselves a king. Now, this is why I've been so strong in my comments about kingship of Saul not being what God wanted for them at this time. They are jumping the gun, and they are selecting the wrong sort of person. Yes, I know. Saul was selected by Samuel at God's direction. But remember, God warned them that He was going to pick the person they were looking for, the type of person they were looking for. And so this was all a bad idea on the part of the Israelites. And so Samuel, acting as God's spokesperson, does not pull any punches. He says, I'm going to give you a supernatural sign so that you will understand you've been bad. You've misbehaved by demanding this type of king. Verse 18, so Samuel called upon He who is, and He who is sent thunder and rain that day. And all the people greatly feared He who is and Samuel. So very surprising for them to have thunder and lightning and apparently a rainstorm come here around the harvest of grain, the wheat harvest. So all the people respond to this scary thing. They said to Samuel, pray for your servants to He who is your God that we may not die, for we've added to all our sins this evil to ask for ourselves a king. So they are repentant on some level. They are sorry that they did it. And Samuel said to the people, do not be afraid. You have done all this evil. Yet do not turn aside from following He who is, but serve He who is with all your heart. So do the right thing. Follow God even ahead of your human king. Do not turn aside after empty things that cannot profit or deliver, for they are empty. For He who is will not forsake His people for His great name's sake. Remember, He who is His name. So for that special name's sake, He's not going to forsake His people because it pleased He who is to make you a people for Himself. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against He who is by ceasing to pray for you. And I will instruct you in the good and right way. Samuel's been at this since he was a teenager. He's been functioning as a prophet to Israel. He's right around 60-something, I'm guessing. So he's been at this a good long time. And he's been Israel's judge ever since the death of Eli, and that was 20 years ago, going on 21 years ago. So he says, why would I ever stop praying for you guys? That's my life. But you have to be involved in this the way it's supposed to be. Verse 24, only fear He who is, and serve Him faithfully with all your heart. For consider what great things He's done for you. But if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king. So there's no doubt about it. Samuel warns the Israelites, you are on shaky ground right now. You demanded a king of the type you wanted. God warned you. You wanted Him anyway. You got Him. Don't push it any farther. Because if you do, God will have to deal with you. Chapter 13, verse number 1, is a tough verse to deal with chronologically. It doesn't even appear in the Greek Septuagint. Remember, the first translation made from Hebrew into another language happened around 280 BC, and it was into Greek. This verse doesn't even appear in the Greek. When you're reading through the Hebrew, it's rough translating. And you will find, if you bounce around between some different English translations, that some of the translators make guesses here because of what they think is trying to be communicated. And so some of them think that there's numbers missing. And so you'll see things like Saul was 31 years old when he became king, or 41 years old when he became king, or that he reigned for 42 years. So they've got all sorts of guesses, and you can tell they're guesses because they put the numbers in italics, which is the signal agreed upon by English translators that this literal word does not appear in the original text. We are supplying it from our own guesses, our own concepts. I think it is much better to just use only what's in the text. And even then, it's a little rough to deal with. I am pleased that the English Standard Version that we're using today doesn't try to make any suppositions or guesses. This is what they have. Let me read it to you first. Saul lived for 1 year and then became king. And when he had reigned for 2 years over Israel, and then it goes into the next thing that he does. So when you first read it in English, it almost sounds like Saul became king when he was a year old. But that's not possible. We know from all the other information we gather here that he had to have been in his early 40s because we know his son Jonathan is an adult serving in the militia. And so that makes him at least 20. Saul is not 1 year old when he becomes king. So I think a better way of understanding what the Hebrew represents here is that Saul was king for a year. I think it's a summary of what we've just read in Saul's story, that he gets anointed by Saul, by Prophet Samuel at some point in the first calendar year that we're looking at here. And then sometime during the later months that followed, he gets publicly declared to be king by the Israelis at a special meeting. And then the following spring, when Nahash the Ammonite comes, he responds by calling up the militia and goes and defeats him. And so that's all 1 year's time or so that we've already got under our belt by the time we come to this verse. So Saul had been king for about a year. Does that make sense? I hope so. Then the next line, and when he had reigned for 2 years over Israel, which I would translate as, and in his second year of reign over Israel, this is what he did. So if you look at the indication in later stories about kings in Israel, it almost seems as if they adopted a procedure of declaring a kingship in the fall in Israel. It might relate to Saul being declared king in the fall at the Feast of Tabernacles or sometime there in that seventh month. And so they would follow a fall-to-fall year for kingship. And so we're in like the second calendar year of Saul's kingdom by the time we get to verse number 2. Saul chose 3,000 men of Israel. Now, he already has a militia that he can call up, but he's now doing something that God told Samuel to warn the Israelites a king would do, and that is start adopting a standing army that were always around him and ready to fight. So he had 3,000 men that he now employs as his army. 2,000 of them were with Saul in Michmash and the hill country of Bethel. Now, Michmash is about 4 miles or so north of Gibeah. Gibeah is Saul's hometown, and it is practically the capital of this new kingdom of Saul. And so about 4 miles north of there, he's got about 2,000 of his 3,000 soldiers. 1,000 of them were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. So they're at the capital city, we will say. The rest of the people he sent home, every man to his tent. So the militia that had come out to help take on Nahash during the wheat harvest, they've all been dismissed. They've all been sent home, except for Saul's standing army of 3,000. What's he going to do with this? Well, he's going to start clearing the other troublemaker group out of the area. Verse 3, Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines that were at Geba. Now, Geba is just about 3 miles north of Gibeah, which means it's about a mile south of Michmash. And this garrison is probably a trade mission, ostensibly, that the Philistines had in several different places inside of Israeli territory. But they would have had a security detail to kind of protect their trade interests. And so it would appear that Saul gives the order, I want all these Philistines out of here, especially their armed security personnel. They need to be gone. And so Jonathan, his eldest son, he goes and evicts the security detail that's at Geba. Now, they've already done that at Gibeah. Now, the Philistines heard of it. And they probably also heard that Nahash, the Ammonite, had just got his clock cleaned earlier in the year. And so the Philistines decide that they can't let this happen. They have to protect their own mercantile and security interests, even inside Israeli territory. It's been about 19 years since Samuel, maybe closer to 18 now, actually, since Samuel defeated the Philistines at the Battle of Ebenezer, and they have not done any military invasions of Israeli territory since then. But this now changes because of the actions of Saul and Jonathan. And so as soon as it becomes obvious that there's going to be another Philistine invasion, Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land and said, let the Hebrews hear. All Israel heard it said that Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become a stench to the Philistines. And so the people were called out to join Saul at Gilgal. So by taking this action and having the military response of the Philistines, it becomes obvious that there's going to be a fight between the Israelis and the Philistines. And so they need the militia back out again. And so he blows the shofar, which is a call to action. And the order is for all military-aged and capable Israeli men to show up at Gilgal again. Now, why Gilgal? Probably just because of the tradition of the place. That's the place from which Joshua did all of his early military work. And so it's probably pretty significant. It's also in the heartland of Israel. It's down by Jericho, down in the Jordan Valley. It's on the eastern edge of Benjamite territory. And of course, Saul comes from the tribe of Benjamin. So it's probably a good safe place for them to muster up their forces and get ready for a fight. But it would appear that the Philistines are overcompensating. They figure, here we are 17 or so years since the last time we got whooped really bad by Israel. We're not going to take any chances. So verse 5 says, the Philistines mustered to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots. Now, they live down in the coastal plain of the Med. And so those chariots come in quite handy in that area. They're not going to be as helpful up in the interior of Israel because it's not so flat, but they bring them anyway. And 6,000 horsemen. Horses do better on flat land, but they can be used in hill country. So this is a pretty good military force. And then troops, like the sand on the seashore in multitude. So no number put on it. So we can probably be pretty sure. And it's several tens of thousands of foot soldiers that are being brought up here. So this is a very significant military invasion. They came up and encamped at Michmash. Now, why there? Because Michmash is just north of Geba, which is where the forces of Jonathan kicked out the security forces of the Philistines at their little trade outpost. And so they're coming to punish at the exact same place that the offense occurred. It's also a good place for them to kind of spread out north of Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, and to kind of hem in the northern border of Saul's heartland, his home territory. When the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, for the people were hard-pressed. I mean, as soon as they see how big this military force is, the people hid themselves in caves and in holes and in rocks and in tombs and in cisterns. So they are hiding everywhere to try to keep out of sight of the invading Philistines. Some Hebrews even crossed the fords of the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. So they go across the Jordan Valley and hide out over there. They don't show up to be mustered by the king, Saul. Saul was still at Gilgal, all the people following him trembling. So everybody's scared about this upcoming fight. He waited 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel. Now this goes back several months, maybe a year or so, to when Samuel first anointed Saul as king. That was the year before calendar-wise, but just a little over a year when you take in consideration the passage of months. He told him there was going to be a time at which you would be mustering people at the city of Gilgal. You must wait for me to arrive a total of 7 days. This is what that prophecy was about. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal. and the people were scattering from him. Now remember that Israeli days go from sunset to sunset. So the seventh day is winding down as the sun is dipping toward the western horizon. The daylight hours are closing up. And so Saul at Gilgal has waited seven full days. People are abandoning him in droves still. Even the ones that showed up to be mustered are starting to melt away because they're so scared about the prospect of going against this massive Philistine invasion. And so as the sun is getting ready to go down, Saul said, "Bring the burnt offering here to me and the peace offerings." So what he was supposed to wait for was for a religious service overseen by the prophet Samuel, acting, I suppose, as the chaplain of the militia force of Israel, to go out with the blessing of God to do this work. And so Saul gets antsy and finally decides this has got to get done. And so he offered the burnt offering. Now, that doesn't mean he himself did it. We'll discover later that he actually has a high priest that's going around with him everywhere. He has the Ark of the Covenant with him, apparently, too. And so they do the sacrifice at his order. As soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. So Samuel arrives just before sunset, so right at the tail end of the seven-day period, and I'm sure God told him to do it exactly that way as a test to Saul's obedience. And so here we are, sunset is coming, Saul has offered the sacrifice in violation of the law, and Samuel shows up.